Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Lieutenant General Michael Peterson, U.S. Air Force, Chief of Warfighting Integration, and Chief Information Officer. Also joining us in our conversation is Dave Hathaway, partner in IBM's Defense Industry Practice. General, the cost of sustaining about 19,000 legacy applications must be absolutely staggering. I understand that you save approximately $1 million for every legacy application retired or moved onto the Air Force portal or the Global Combat Support System. Could you elaborate on the development of the Global Combat Support System and the Air Force's portal? How does it enable your force to achieve a broader net-centric data transparent capability? And are there plans to migrate to a single DoD portal?
Hal, thanks for the question because it's an important issue. Yes, the legacy platforms are very expensive to sustain. The sustainment is mostly about keeping those legacy platforms or systems talking to or interoperating with sister systems. That's where about 80% of the sustainment dollars go. And this is not modernizing. This is just keeping them running. The Global Combat Support System was built as a framework for our support systems. There's always a fuzzy gray line between what's a support system and what's an operational system. When the Air Force went down the road of a portal, that portal was simply a presentation layer of information that was on our integration framework. So we looked across the Air Force at lines of business, logistics, human resources, financials. And as we looked at the multitude of systems, you are correct, 19,000 different applications out there that the Air Force sustains every year. But as we looked at those lines of business, we recognized that if we took those lines of business and started building them with common protocols, common standards, common services embedded in them, then the cost of in that line of business sustaining those systems would go down dramatically. So GCSS Air Force, that's the acronym we use for the Global Combat Support System, was not so much a portal. It was the integration framework on which we were going to host services. So when I asked you to build the next munition tracking system, you only had to build the piece that tracked munitions, not the messaging software, not the database administrator. All of those services were already available on the integration framework, and you were automatically interoperable with. That vision has continued to grow across the Air Force. Today, as we build out GCSS Air Force, the other thing it gives us is a way to put information where it belongs. Example, when we originally built capability in the Air Force, it's wherever that information was created was generally where we plopped down the server that would do business with all of our partners. So to come in and to access that information, you were able to traverse much of the Air Force network. So now with GCSS Air Force, where we are able to host those systems, those applications at the edge of our network so you can get to that information without traversing the network. Security, you don't have to run a single server for a single application. Efficiency, it's made the network much tighter, much more efficient in terms of running it. The integration aspect of the framework has made it easier to build systems. The portal, on the other hand, still remains simply a user interface or a presentation layer to that information for different lines of business. Now, you asked, well, what about eventually a DoD framework and portal? You compare the Air Force portal to today's Army portal, Defense Knowledge Online, which is a joint perspective. Their portal and their presentation layer offers much more service and capability than the Air Force portal. I mean, it's a wonderful tool for a unit to manage a deployment of soldiers and to keep them engaged with families back home, for families to be able to understand what the unit's doing. It's a very rich capability. The Army, on the other hand, has not made the investment on the integration framework. It's not that they don't intend to. It's just where they are in the program. So, yes, I would very much like us to come together out there in the future as the contracts for DKO, Defense Knowledge Online, and the contracts for GCSS Air Force, when the timelines come together, I'd very much like to have a single offering. Should that not be possible, there is still the opportunity to have a federation. What do I mean by that? The real reason you want to be under a single framework is so if I'm the Joint Force Commander and I need information about an Air Force line of business that is hosted on the Air Force portal to the integration framework, GCSS Air Force, then somehow I've got to get to that information. The system won't let me get to the information unless it knows who I am. The way you work around that is you share a common identity management service. You exchange certificates. And you can do those. It's the technique is called federation. You just have to decide what are those core services that have to be common. It doesn't matter what the look and feel is. It best suit your line of business or your operational need.
So it's really about driving interoperability across the DoD as opposed to within the various lines of service.
Right. And because we don't fight as services. We fight as a team. And that is the test of whether or not we will be successful is if some deployed soldier, sailor, airman, marine can get the information that he or she needs exactly when they need it without 15 phone calls and having somebody else log into the computer for you.
General, as a component of the Air Force's larger communications and information strategic transformation, would you discuss your efforts to implement an integrated network operations and security center, or the INOSC? And how does the INOSC initiative reduce your footprint and increase process and personnel efficiencies?
Briefly, I told you how we built our networks. We built them one room at a time, one building at a time, one group of buildings at a time, one base at a time. That's how our networks grew up. Industry brought tools along for consolidation, so you reduce the overhead cost of operating a network. One of the reasons that we did not immediately follow that was we wanted each air wing, space wing, to be complete, to have its own embedded capability. So what we have done is step back from our network and said we will operate this as an enterprise. When we started, we had 17 separate network operations and security centers and well over 120 network control centers. You don't need that many, even as a network as large as ours. Today, we have two integrated network operations and security centers, divide up the work and have a continuity of operations plan where one could back up the other. And that's a standard business practice. But to do that, we had to make investments in modern network management tools. On a side note, when I first arrived in the job, I was very concerned, of course, about network security. And so we went down the path of a standard desktop configuration, a standard server configuration for purposes of security. Well, now we've implemented a standard desktop solution, and we're well along on a standard server solution so that we can do all of the patching remotely. And it's no longer requires touch maintenance. Today, it's ours to patch the network, and it's because of the tools that we've adopted. We did that for the purposes of security. I didn't understand until later that, my goodness, all of the workload we took off the shoulders of those systems administrators. I was at the Pentagon just a couple of months ago, and a staff sergeant, Air Force staff sergeant, got on the bus, and he walked by me up the aisle, and he stopped, and he said, "Sir, I'm a systems administrator. I just arrived here from Hill Air Force Base." He said, "We were working 65 hours a week, me and my team, and we were getting farther and farther behind on patches. We could not keep the systems patched until standard desktop came along." He said, "When I left, we were already had cut our workload down to just under 50 hours a week. He says, "I think by the time we're done, we'll be working less than 40 hours a week." That's when the other shoe dropped. He said, "That's really a good news story because you know we're going to reduce the number of systems administrators we have next year."
Right.
Well, you know, we are reducing the manpower in the U.S. Air Force, but it's leveraging information technology, whether it's in the IT arena or the human resources or finances or logistics, has played a huge role in being able to reduce the required manpower and still be very effective in an operational environment.
Sir, you mentioned the personnel cuts being experienced by the Air Force. The Air Force is experiencing these reductions as a result of PBD 720. How are you successfully meeting your mission requirements while at the same time absorbing these reductions?
Well, that's a timely question. We knew that if we embraced industry best practices, moved on to next-generation software and tools, that we could be much more efficient across the Air Force. And as I said, it's not just IT. It's logistics. It's human resources. It's finance. It's every single thing we do, we could become more efficient. Understanding that, the Secretary of the Air Force and our chief were faced with a dilemma. Our Air Force really had not recapitalized its capability through the 90s and into the first 5 years of this decade. We are flying aircraft whose average age is 24 years. In fact, Navy ships on average aren't that old. We had to get started on recapitalizing, and you've seen what we've done with our next generation tanker, combat search and rescue platform, where we need to go with aging fighter and bomber aircraft. And you've seen that in the news, but the problem is so huge that you have to start now. It will take us 25 years to recapitalize the tanker force alone. Well, in the middle of a war on terror, the resources for recapitalization simply are not going to be there from external sources. There's a fight going on in the desert. There's a fight going on globally, and that's where our attention is focused. So to find dollars for recapitalization, what could we do internally? And that's when the Chief and the Secretary realized that we could embrace, as I said, industry best practices and tools, become a process-based organization, and we could create our own recapitalization capital. This was not about taking away warfighting capability. In fact, if you do this correctly, you increase your warfighting effectiveness, at the same time reducing the manpower requirements for the mission support arena. And that's what we've done. The example of Standard Desktop, the example of INOSCs, those and some others have allowed us to take the first 6,000 personnel out of network services delivery. We need to do more. If you look at my common operational picture that I spoke about earlier, I can map initiative after initiative to the manpower that it will reduce and that has already begun to reduce in the Air Force IT arena. For instance, no one in industry would have a help desk at every Air Force base. We do. We're consolidating help desks. No one would have a server farm at every Air Force base, given the modern network paths that are available to us. But we do. Those are the examples of the other, and there are 13 initiatives that every single one was looking over the hedge at industry and asking, so how are you doing this? And we're getting great partnership because we're finally getting some unsolicited proposals for how we might better conduct telephone operations across the Air Force. Companies that have investment dollars and great ideas that I think you'll see us implement. While at the same time we've done that, I can go back to our Air Expeditionary Force. That's how we build our packages to deploy and how we go to war. And I can map all of the capability required in each AEF package back to capability that still exists that's not going away. Now, what do I mean by that? We would have tanker aircraft go into depot for their maintenance cycle that comes every few years. And they would be there so long that aircraft would just pile up in the depots as we work them through the process line. But today, they're coming out so much more rapidly, it equates to more than a squadron of airplanes back on the ramp available to fly missions. Those are the kind of efficiencies, and if you can do it quicker, you can do it with less manpower. That's the kind of example. So PVD 720, it is difficult because it's something you have to do quickly and move out. The dollars that we would have spent, we will invest in the recapitalization of the Air Force.
General, changing topics a bit here, could you tell us a little bit about something called Rover, the Remote Operations Video Enhanced Receiver? How has the Rover technology tightened the seams in the so-called kill train in increasing the speed and lethality of air power? And could you illustrate this with a real-life example?
Sure. And the Rover is a great example. In the airborne environment, we have – it's rich with information, data links, imagery from targeting pods, access to the images that a Predator unmanned aerial vehicle would provide. But as we got into the desert initially, that information wasn't immediately available to the soldier, the Marine, the battlefield airman on the ground. Yes, they could get a radio call, but they couldn't see moving imagery or – the picture of what was over the hill or what was in the compound that they were focused on as the target. Rover came from initially the Predator. The AC-130 gunship wanted to know if Predator imagery can be sent all around the world, why can't I see it? So for the Predator, we put together a very simple receiver and a laptop computer, And so if there is a predator in your area, you tune to that frequency and you take the downlink to the predator and you see exactly what the predator sees. Now, we're on version 3 of Rover, and it's much more capable now in terms of that feedback loop of how I ask for information and provide feedback to the operator. And it's not just Predator. It's many of the targeting pods that are on our fighter and strike aircraft also have a transmitter now embedded in them that allows them to go direct to the rover. Lots of battlefield examples. But one that's a little closer to home is after Hurricane Katrina, we took 10 rover sets, which was a little tiny hand-launched styrofoam UAV with a camera and a transmitter. That was the picture piece. And then the rover itself was the receiver unit on the ground. And we took them to New Orleans to help with the recovery effort. And initially the thought was these will help with search and rescue as we find those victims that are stranded on rooftops or need assistance across the city. But with all of the helicopter traffic, it didn't look wise to be flying more UAVs. And so since they were styrofoam airplanes, we cut the wings off and strapped them to the struts of helicopters and gave great situational awareness to the commanders back at the op centers to see what was going on with the helicopters. Now, the helicopters were busy doing real search and rescue, so they weren't busy pointing the rover around where the commander might want to see something else. So that became a signal of opportunity. You know, I'll watch it, but I'm not going to try to steal the helicopter time from what they're doing. So what we did was on one of the taller buildings there in the city, we went up and put 4 of the styrofoam bodies and taped the cameras on an antenna tower on top of a hotel in town. So you had a 360-degree panoramic view of the city. And that's where we got warning when you saw the fires, where you saw and you could steer the camera, where we had other activities going on the ground where you could alert law enforcement or search and rescue. That became the eyes of the commander in the ops center and extremely valuable. Today there are over 3,000 rover units over in the theater, more on the way. As I said, incredibly valuable, but just literally one of dozens and dozens of innovations that were out there that industry has helped us put together that we get to put to use every single day in the fight on terror.
That's a great piece of technology. What does the future hold for the Air Force's IT efforts? We will ask Lieutenant General Michael Peterson, U.S. Air Force, Chief of Warfighting Integration and Chief Information Officer, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.